Okay, hopefully by the end of the talk I will be ready to answer whether jets are suppressed at RIC. What I'm going to do is say a few words about the experimental probes of experimental high PT probes, not too much since that has been introduced extensively already. I'm going to show high PT results at RIC, single particle spectra. I'll say a little bit about particle correlations and differences from proton-proton collision spectra and what's seen at lower square root of S. I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about conventional explanations, in particular to what extent does shadowing explain what we see. And then I'm going to show some systematics with the particle type, which we've seen already yesterday from Tom Himmick, and also with centrality. And I want to say something about the PT range of hard versus soft processes, because I think that's important in how strongly we can interpret observables at what PT range. And then we'll see. So at this conference, we've been hearing, I think, experimental observables of two different types. The first type is to study the collision dynamics. And these are the kinds of observables that really come from the hadronic final state. We ask, is there equilibrium achieved? And we look at, you've seen the spectra, correlations, particle yields to try to address that. And then look at the collective behavior, again, elliptic and radial flow, as well as two-particle correlations. For high PT, of course, the motivation is to try and probe the early phase of the collisions. And the idea, as in this very simple cartoon, is if you can make the probe at the very beginning and then look for something that's modified by the medium, as we've been hearing. Now, I have the nice Axel cartoon also. The main point I want to make with this is that in heavy ion collisions, the best way to study jets is actually via the leading particle. The main reason for that, of course, is the bath of all of the other hadrons around. And since the cross section is steeply falling with PT, most of our jets are not that high of PT, and so the fragmentation particles include quite low PT particles, and it's hard to fish those out of the bath. And that's why mostly what you've seen is a focus on the leading particles. Of course, this cartoon also says that one would like to look at the correlation among the leading particle of the one scattered, from the jet of the one scattered parton and the other one. And I'll show a little bit about that, and Peter Jacobs will show more. So the two large experiments are the source of most of the results on high PT, and I'm not going to describe them any further. The first thing, of course, that one can look at is just the charged particle spectrum. And I wanted to show this plot because it's one of the very first answers to the question of, are the data right? This is the charged particle spectrum from Phoenix in the white squares and Star in the red circles. And those are in central collisions. And you can see that they agree quite well. I also want to point out that the PT range out to 5 or 6 GeV is considerably larger than what was seen at the SPS. I'm going to come back to that. Now, in Phoenix, we also can measure high PT hadron spectra via the pi zeros. And here is the invariant mass plot of photon pairs, just to show you that we can quite nicely measure the pi zero. And what's plotted here are the pi zero spectra for peripheral and central collisions. And if you look very closely, you'll see there are two different types of symbols. One is a measurement in a lead scintillator calorimeter. Another one is a completely independent analysis of the pi zeros in a lead glass calorimeter. And they agree very well. So the main point I'm giving you here is that when you look at the suppression, which we've already been looked at, we do know the data are right because they've been measured in several different ways by two different experiments. Now, as we've already seen, the first thing one would do is compare the measured PT spectra to those from proton-proton collisions. We've seen this plot before. It's the PT spectrum of charged particles and proton-proton collisions at a variety of different square root of s. And the main point I want to make is this solid line here corresponds to 130 GeV root s, and you'll notice there are no data points on it. So what all of the comparisons you've been seeing so far, and also what I'll show you for root s 130, are compared to an interpolation, and when you see somewhat different reference spectra among different experiments, or Shenyang compared to Phoenix, that slight difference is in this interpolation. The way that Phoenix did that is to fit a power law and then interpolate the power law parameters. And the other experiments did something similar. Okay, this is a plot that also you've seen from Tom Hemmick yesterday. What's plotted here are the charge hadron spectra from Phoenix in peripheral and central collisions, and also the Pi0 spectra in peripheral and central collisions. So asking that first question of are they any different than simply summing up the nucleon-nucleon collisions, what we've done is we've taken that interpolated proton-proton spectrum, scaled it by the number of binary collisions that correspond to the peripheral and central collision bin definitions for Phoenix, and then plotted those overlaid with the gold-gold data. The range here shows the uncertainty in the reference spectrum. That's primarily from the extrapolation. And if you look at that carefully, you say that uncertainty is big. That's true, and that's why you've already heard us say how important it is that we've measured the proton-proton reference spectrum. We've measured it, but we haven't finished analyzing it, which is why, unfortunately, I can't show it to you today, but soon. What you see is for both the charged and the pi-zeros, the peripheral spectra in gold-gold agree quite well with the scaled proton-proton distributions. And if you make the same comparison for central gold-gold collisions, you see that there's a deficit both in the charged and in the pi-zero. Now, we calculate a nuclear modification factor. Of course, we've been seeing that already in several talks. What we actually measure, of course, is the yield in nucleus-nucleus collisions. And what this RAA modification factor is just the yield in gold-gold divided by the yield in proton-proton collisions at the same transverse momentum, scaled by the number of binary collisions, which is always done from the Glauber calculation. Now, if there are no nuclear effects, then you would naively expect this ratio to be 1 in a regime where hard scattering dominates. And that's why all of the figures always show 1 with a solid line through them is to guide the expectation. And departures from 1 are going to measure nuclear effects. We know that there should be KT broadening in nuclei, and that will make this nuclear modification factor larger than 1. We know that multiple scattering would also do that. We expect that if there is energy loss, or if you don't make the hard scattered partons to begin with, then the ratio could be less than 1. And we also see that in the very soft physics regime, this ratio is less than 1. And that's for the simple reason that the soft particle production scales as the number of participating nucleons rather than the number of binary collisions. And so here's the plot then that we've seen a zillion times already. I guess the main point that I want to make with this slide is that the deficit was seen in both Phoenix and Star. And if you do a careful comparison at the same PTs, you find out that the two measurements are consistent. The range up here, which I can't reach because I'm too short, is to indicate what the... That's okay.
You want the bigger
stage? No, I'll goof up with that one. That range is just where the CERN data lie, and I'll show that in more detail in a moment. And these triangles here are the nuclear modification factor observed in alpha-alpha collisions at the ISR. So pretty small nuclei, but the RAA is still somewhat larger than 1. Now, of course, there are known effects. We've seen those in Uxel's talk in some detail. One sees that in proton nucleus, sulfur-sulfur, sulfur-gold collisions. This quantity plotted here is exactly the same as RAA. As a function of transverse momentum, you see that above maybe 1.5 GeV, it rises above 1, and that's generally ascribed to multiple scattering, either initial state multiple scattering or KT broadening or some combination thereof. And that was seen in lead-lead collisions at CERN also, and my range there spans this data. And I just want to point out with this plot that the CERN enhanced, the CERN RAA larger than 1 is also clearly a correct measurement since it's measured by 3 different experiments. So that it's not that we have some problem with the data here. Now, seeing this, one sees that if there is any parton energy loss at CERN, it's overwhelmed by the initial state soft multiple scattering. This doesn't necessarily specify that there is no parton energy loss. It just says that it's not big enough to compensate the multiple scattering. Now, of course, I've been comparing the spectra from CERN and RIC at the same PT. And that's, of course, not exactly fair because the same PT at different square root of S implies different values of X. So what I've done here is just replotted the RAA as a function of XT. And if the PT of the leading hadron is equal to the PT of the jet, so if you only have one hadron fragmenting, the jet fragments into one single hadron, then XT just gives you the X of the parton. And you see that the RIC data correspond to smaller X than CERN, as of course you expect. Now, of course, one should use a somewhat more realistic fragmentation function to do this comparison. And the easiest way to do that is to use the fragmentation function that's included in Hijing. And so thanks to Xin Yan for fishing that out for us. What this plot has is now a horizontal range for each of our RAA values that correspond to the X range. And the width comes from looking at the width of the Z distribution in the fragmentation function. What you see is that it doesn't really change the answer very much. The X range of our high PT particles at RIC is few times 10 to the minus 2. And I've marked here, this from this point on, those are PT hadrons of PT 3 GeV or higher. And I think that's the right place to look if we're looking for hard scattering. And I'll justify that in a moment. So what do we see? This plot shows two things. One is, of course, there is a very large difference. And the other one is telling us which X range. And then we can ask, is do we need to worry about shadowing? So what's plotted here are shadowing. Basically, the quark structure functions for the ratio of the structure function for nuclei over the A times the nucleon structure function at different Q squareds for quarks. And here's a calculation for gluons. The main point I want to make here is with this purple bar as indicated the X range that we're probing at RIC. And I think it's pretty clear that we don't need to worry about shadowing modifying the RAA value. So that says that the PT comparison that I've been making is OK. I think it's a fairly simple-minded comment just from looking at how different those are than here. And it's probably completely model dependent. But I think in either case, they're pretty small effects. Now, I talked about the uncertainty in the proton reference spectrum, the denominator in RAA. So one could try and do a better job with the systematics by using our own peripheral collisions. And this is the plot of the same kind of ratio, only now we use the measured gold-gold peripheral collisions as the denominator. And you see that there is still a suppression RAA is significantly less than 1. If you look carefully, you see that the systematic errors are still pretty huge. And that's because the systematic error in this case is dominated by the uncertainty in the number of binary collisions in the peripheral data. And the main reason for that is, experimentally, when you try to figure out just how peripheral is your collision, it's very difficult. You have a large uncertainty that comes from not knowing exactly what fraction of the total cross-section your trigger is sensitive to. So I think the right way to fix the uncertainty in the reference spectrum is via the measurement of the PP. Now, I'd like to turn to this question that you've seen in each one, and in each one of these figures, and that was also discussed a bit by Tom Hemmick, namely that the suppression factor always looks to be a larger suppression for pions than for the summed charge hadrons. So, of course, to investigate that, we separate the charge hadron spectrum into its components. This is the transverse mass distribution of pions, kaons, and protons in min-bias gold-gold. And the fact that the proton spectrum is flatter than the pion spectrum is what initially motivated people to think that there may be a velocity boost coming from hydrodynamic expansion. Of course, gluon saturation also will give you something close to MT scaling, and I'm going to come back to that. Now, one plots the spectra instead as a function of transverse momentum rather than transverse mass, then you see what's already been commented on several times, that by the time you get to 2 GeV or so, the spectrum is approximately half baryons or antibaryons. So right away, you would expect that the baryons would change the apparent suppression factor. Now, having a spectrum that's half baryons is not at all the expected jet fragmentation function, and so that right away makes you suspicious that you're looking at a mix of physics processes. This plot here is a comparison of the Phoenix pion and antiproton spectrum with a hydrodynamical calculation from Edward and Derek Tini, and I have to apologize to Uli Heinz. I have a very similar plot comparing to his hydrodynamical calculation. They agree also, but I only picked this one for the picture. So what do you see here? Well, you see that the boost in the PT of the baryons is very nicely predicted by the hydrodynamics. And in fact, the spectra running into each other above 2 GeV, and the mix then half and half pions and baryons is what you expect if you have a rather large hydrodynamic expansion. I should make a point that what we heard from the last speaker was primarily focused on a longitudinal expansion, but here there's also a transverse expansion. Now, what we've done is we've used the assertion that there's a hydrodynamic expansion, and then checked, is that consistent with all of the single particle spectra? The way we did that was by doing a fit with a hydrodynamically inspired functional form. You can see here the fits to pions, kaons, protons of both signs, all the different centralities. And you see that it actually does fit reasonably well, with the exception of the pions and the peripheral collisions. So if you do a fit like this, and I should emphasize that we only included in the fit the low momentum part, where you have some justification for arguing that you're looking at soft physics. If you do that fit, you find out that you have a freeze-out temperature around 120 MeV and a maximum transverse velocity of a little more than 0.7 times the speed of light. So what one can do then, armed with these parameters and the parameterization of the functional form, is to use that to extrapolate the soft spectrum beyond the region where we fit, extrapolate it to higher PT, and see, does that completely explain the data? So the various dotted lines here are the pion, kaon, and proton spectra extrapolated using the hydrodynamical form out to PT up to 3.5 GeV. If you sum them up, then you get the extrapolated total charge particle spectrum. And then over here on the right-hand side, we compare that for central collisions to the measured total charge particle spectrum. And what you see is that the extrapolation agrees with the data quite well, up to almost 3 GeV. So if you want to look for hard processes and not get confused by the soft physics, mostly in the form of the baryons, what you need to do is to look at least 3.5 GeV. 4 GeV is better. It's cleaner of the baryon contribution from the hydrodynamical boost. So that really tells us that when we look at the suppression factor, the right place to look is really at the high PT end. Now, I added the slide to my talk yesterday. It's for Bernd Muller, who's not here, unfortunately. He questioned the statement that Rick owns jet quenching. This plot is the result of the exact same procedure being done on the SPS data. And what's shown here, the colored bands correspond to the extrapolated soft spectra from lead-lead, sulfur gold, sulfur-sulfur, and proton tungsten at SPS energy. And what you see in the proton on nucleus, the hydrodynamical expansion, of course, completely deviates from the data above a GeV and a half, as we would expect. But for the nucleus-nucleus, and look, if you will, at the lead-lead, you see that the lead-lead data up to the PT range that has been measured can be quite well explained by the soft physics. I don't think that says that there absolutely can't be any hard scattering in there, but it means that when you look at the spectrum, it's not dominated by hard processes. So why didn't we see jet quenching at the SPS? I think the answer is that we weren't looking at high enough PT. Now, I want to make a note with this extrapolation of the soft physics. What we've done is use the assertion of hydrodynamics to extrapolate the soft spectrum, since gluon saturation also gives a rather similar MT spectra and reproduces the Phoenix mean PT of the measured mean PT. That would also say that gluon saturation, which I call a soft process, will have the same net effect. Namely, if you want to look for hard scattering, you still have to look at quite high PT above the spectra that are dominated by the soft processes. Now, as we've seen from the hydrodynamical comparison, the hard-soft boundary is different for different particle species. It's at a higher PT for baryons than it is for pions. And that was predicted, well, maybe post-dicted in this calculation by Vitev and Gelassi, where what they did was they plotted the antiproton over the pi minus ratio as a function of PT in a calculation with two ingredients. One is a hydrodynamical transverse expansion, and then the other one is jet quenching. And so what happens is that this ratio goes up, and at the peak, it's dominated by the PT boost in the nucleons. And then it's supposed to come back down because you start running out of high PT baryons, and then the jet quenching dominates and kills off the pions. The plot here on the bottom shows the proton to pion and antiproton to pion ratio from Phoenix. The blue is the ratio to charge pions. The red is the ratio to pi zeros. And it certainly goes up, goes to roughly the right scale. And I think it's too early to conclude from these data whether it turns back over again. We will certainly know the answer to that from the data that were recently taken and are currently being analyzed. OK, so is there energy loss at RIC? Well, this is a plot comparing to the predictions from Xin Yan. And the green is his prediction with energy loss. Agrees with the data. And that corresponds to an energy loss of 0.25 GeV per Fermi. Now, as we just heard, that seems like a kind of low number if we really are having a significant jet quenching. And if he corrects that for expansion, then it corresponds to something like 7 GeV per Fermi for a 10 GeV per ton. And there's a prediction here which shows how this ought to behave if it's really correct. And from the data that we've taken this year, we certainly will be able to go up to at least 10 GeV and check if this is right. Another important point, I think, is that there is a prediction as well for deuteron on gold, and that's really an important measurement to make at RIC. We haven't taken the data yet. Now, it's also instructive to look at the centrality dependence of the spectra if you want to ask, is it jet quenching or something else? Now, what we see here is the charged hadron spectrum from peripheral through different centrality bins to central collisions. And your eye tells you that there is a basic change in the shape. The most peripheral collisions have a very pronounced power law. And as the collisions get more central, the spectrum becomes more exponential. And you can see the shape change better here, where each of these spectra has been divided by the minimum bias spectrum, which is dominated by central collisions. And you see this sort of characteristic break in the spectrum in the peripheral collisions. In the semi-peripheral, there's still some hint of it, and then the spectra become flatter.
Why is minimum bias dominated by central
collisions? Ah, that's actually fairly simple, because when you make the particle spectrum, it's, of course, the PT distribution multiplied by the number of particles, and you have more of them in central collisions. So if we now take those same spectra and calculate RAA and plot that as a function of PT for the different centrality bins, you see here in the purple the most peripheral collisions. And RAA has the same general trend as was seen in the lower energy collisions. Does get to 1, doesn't get to 2. However, it behaves the way we would have naively expected it. And I would argue the fact that it only reaches 1 around 4 GeV is also not a surprise, because it's only there that you're dominantly looking at hard processes. You see that as you go to more and more central collisions, it gradually moves down. And you can see that better here in this lower plot. What we've done here is we've integrated the spectrum above 3.5 GeV. And I would argue that's where you want to look for hard processes. And you see that RAA moves down as you increase the number of participating nucleons. Now, I want to say a few words about the insights from correlations. We've seen this plot a number of times, the V2, the elliptic flow measurement, and how well that agrees with the hydrodynamical expectations. These are, of course, dominated by soft particles. So at low PT, the V2 parameter measures elliptic flow, and that's interpreted, I think, correctly as early pressure buildup and early equilibrium. Now, of course, at high PT, the dominant process changes. And so the question is, what happens to the V2? Now, the turns out there are two different ways of measuring V2. The way that STAR measures it is by identifying the reaction plane and looking how the particles are correlated with that. Phoenix and Phobos measure V2 by measuring an azimuthal correlation function. So here's delta phi for all particles in the same event. Here's the distribution for particles from mixed events, and the shape has to do with the Phoenix acceptance. And if you divide the two, you get a correlation function. You fit that with the Fourier components, and you can extract V2. Now, it's clear that if you impose a PT threshold on this kind of analysis, then you can look at the jet correlations. And this is a somewhat complicated plot, which was made by Jan Rach, but I think has some interesting features. What's plotted here is the V2 as a function of the PT of the probe particle. So as you go up in PT, you're asking how well is the particles of that PT correlated with everything else. The red points are from STAR, and we'll see more of that from Peter Jacob shortly. The blue points here are from Phoenix. Now, first thing I want to point out is that the STAR data are analyzed using the reaction plane method, and the Phoenix data are using the correlation method, and you see that they agree quite well. Now, what does this V2 value of 20% mean? To help understand that, here are two calculations using Heijing events, so events with no elliptic flow, but which do have hard scattering, and so back-to-back jets. This is what you get for V2 if you use the correlation method and look at, you know, what's the correlation among two high PT particles. Well, not too surprisingly, once you get to fairly high PT, you find a correlation, because in Heijing, that's the only way to make high PT particles. I think if you added jets to hydro, you would see the same kind of behavior, but it would move up to higher PT. If you do the reaction plane method on the Heijing events, you see a much smaller V2, and I find it quite remarkable that the data are somewhere in between. Now, we know that around 3 GeV or so, hydrodynamics is no longer dominating, and you would expect that this might move down. And
in two experiments using two different methods, and if results that agree, whereas if it were from jets, they should completely disagree. That tells you that they are not.
Well, there is, of course, one subtlety, and that is when you apply the PT threshold for the correlation method, you get something different. You ask a different question if you apply the PT threshold to one particle. Then you say, how is a particle from the decay of a jet correlated with everything else? And that's the question that's being answered here. If you apply it to both, then you're really looking for the back-to-back jet correlations. Now, I think at this point, we can say that the back-to-back jet correlations are certainly weak, maybe missing. Now, the actual value that one gets of the high PT particle with everything else, I would class at the moment as still a bit of a mystery. And I hope that in the course of this workshop, we can understand that better. Okay, so let me draw some conclusions. I think we've definitely seen new behavior at RIC. High PT particles are definitely suppressed. The data are correct, and it's not shadowing. We see a large V2 at high PT, and it saturates. And I would say at this point, we don't fully understand it, although I know that we're going to see an explanation, and then we can have fun deciding whether we believe it. We may be right. We see that the data are consistent with jet quenching. And in particular, I want to remind you that this jet-like tail decreases with centrality. So I would say it sure looks like the jets go away as you go from peripheral gold-gold to central gold-gold. But the PT range is limited, and the measurements are barely out of the soft regime. Soft regime, of course, having been extended by transverse expansion, if you ask the hydrodynamicists, or perhaps by gluon saturation defining the soft scale, if you ask the saturators. And we'll have to figure out from the data if we can tell them apart. At the moment, we don't know how. And at the moment, we have significant uncertainties in the reference spectrum, which makes makes for an uncertainty in how much suppression. Okay, so are jets quenched? Well, my personal opinion is yes. I actually think they are quenched. However, I think the data is not yet of the appropriate standard of proof level. I think we really need to go out to higher PT. We need to use the measured proton-proton reference spectrum with smaller error bars. We need to look at the back-to-back correlations. We should see those at some point because we know there should be hard scattering. And we need to start to understand quantitatively the near side correlations. And I know we'll see more about that in the next talk. Now, as I said before, it's not clear from the data so far whether the suppression of jets is due to energy loss or no hard scattering. You don't make those hard partons to begin with. That's, I think, a challenge for us to both the experiment and theory to work out to see how can we tell unambiguously. And I just want to remind everybody that the ultimate goal of using the high PT probes isn't just to answer yes or no, are jets suppressed, but rather to measure the energy transport in the plasma. How much energy is lost by that fast parton, and where does it go? And I think in the next year, we're in the process of getting some answers for that. Thank you.
Barbara, I'd like to make a comment about concerns of soft physics extending up into, I don't know, the 3 GeV, 4 GeV, whatever range you're interested in. From my point of view, that would be a much bigger concern if we didn't see any suppression. And then one could argue about, well, maybe there is suppression, but there's other stuff compensating it. However, if you believe that we're producing hard scattered partons and they're fragmenting, and based on PP data, those fragments have a significant contribution in the 2, 3, 4 GeV range. Even if there's some extra contribution coming from flow or whatever you want to call it, the fact that we see a strong reduction compared to sort of the minimal expectation based on hard scattering means that if you were to have flow pushing particles into that region, we're only underestimating the amount of the suppression, right? So while I agree with you that one needs to get a quantitative, if you wanted a quantitative understanding of exactly how much suppression there was, you would have to account for all these other effects. Nonetheless, the fact that RAA is well below one, right, means that something is going on to the hard scattering contributions.
Two comments to that. One of them is I certainly agree. I think, however, if we want to really pin it down, the right place to look is where we don't have a mixture of processes. Doesn't mean that there's absolutely no hard scattering. Just means that we're looking at a mix and it's hard to disentangle it. Let's look above 4 GeV where it's cleaner. You're right that we're probably underestimating how much suppression there is, because there is no reason to expect absolutely no Cronin effect at RIC. So it could well be that where we expect the RAA to be is well above one, and what we see is well below one.
Yeah, in response to Brian's comment and also to Barbara's comment about the absence of shadowing, if you're talking about leading twist shadowing, I wouldn't disagree with you, but if you talk about stuff which is non-leading twist and stuff which comes from saturation, that can quite easily suppress stuff.
That's the ultimate shadowing.
Yeah, it's the ultimate shadowing, and it's non-leading twist, and you'd miss it if you looked at deep inelastic data at large Q-squared. So I think the issue of whether or not it's, quote, soft, unquote, in that sense is still wide open.
Well, wouldn't you agree that the completely shadowed case means that the soft regime really continues to higher PT than in PQ collisions?
Yeah, I'm agreeing. I'm agreeing with you and disagreeing with Brian.
The prediction from saturation, right, is that the QS scale should go up with centrality. That means that the PT spectrum should scale with QS and should have. Yeah, but independent of the absolute normalization, we have data that show the mean PT above 2 GeV actually decreases as you go to more central collisions, independent of the actual overall yield. Right, so the slope becomes steeper. That means the spectrum is falling off more steeply. That's inconsistent with the expectations from shadowing. Well, I'd like to, saturation.
Perhaps a sacrilegious question. At the very beginning, you were showing that all of your spectra were well fit by hydro out to 3 GeV or 3.5 GeV or so. Has anyone ever taken, and as a function of centrality as well, has anyone ever taken the ratios for hydro from central to peripheral to see whether it looks like this?
Let's see. You mean at higher PT? Let me first find
even out to 3.5 GeV or so, where you say they fit well. Just to see if you have the same, you know, turnover as the data looking like quenching.
So you want to know what happens above 3 GeV in the ratio.
If you just take all this, take hydro and go central to peripheral for hydro, does it fit the data that you have? Exhibits.
Well, yeah, right. I think I don't understand your question, because if you fit the central and the peripheral spectra,
right,
then you fit the ratio.
So doesn't that mean that hydro also predicts this suppression out to 4 GeV or so? I mean, it has the same behavior as the jet quenching figure.
The RAA has in it a factor of the number of binary collisions. If you make the ratio from hydro, you don't really have a good physics justification for scaling that with binary collisions. Yeah, I mean, if you stuck the binary in, you'd get RAA back, but it wouldn't mean anything. Well, there is a deviation here in the peripheral collisions, yes, and also in the very low PT where you expect resonance decays that weren't in the FIP.
I have a comment and a question. The comment first is, we have now in Ceres also measured the V2 up to about 2.5 GeV, and it rises and levels off in the analysis using the event plane. And if we use the correlation method, actually there's a slight difference. What that means, I don't know, but it's actually higher in the correlation method, as you would expect if there is some jet component. Well, so not now, so that was my comment. My question is, if you really look at the data on face value, it's really hard to see that there is any qualitative difference between 3 and 4 GeV, and I don't really quite follow a statement that 3 GeV is soft and 4 is hard. But my comment is really, my question is, isn't the most interesting fact of these results that somehow you end up with protons being nearly the dominant factor in the spectrum, and shouldn't one rather focus on that rather on the question whether this is jet quenching or not jet quenching?
So let me respond to both. Now, what the point I'm trying to make is that at 3 GeV, the dominant contribution is soft. You soak up most of the cross-section, most of the measured charge hadron cross-section with the soft processes. At 3.5, you have a mixture. I think that's okay, but it means if you want to study hard processes, you're going to have an additional confusion factor. And that's the main point I want to make, that if we want to go where it's clean to study hard processes, we should go to where the extrapolated soft stuff is well below the measured cross-section. It's not a deeper comment than that. It's just how to do it more cleanly.
But it doesn't look like the proton contribution to those spectra goes down as you go out, just from your data.
Let's see. Well,
at least I could not see that at all. The proton contribution still goes up, or is at least constant.
We had a lot of very interesting discussions about that, and that is in this plot. Oops.
Exactly.
Right. Does it get?
Yeah.
Is it flat? Does it go down?
Even in the hydro limit, it should reach 2. So it seems to have reached the hydro limits.
I think there are two things we have to do experimentally. One of them is, in this range, around 4 GeV, it's more intelligent to compare to the identified pi zeros than the total charge.
Sure.
And we've got to extend this measurement to see whether the protons go back down as they should. Otherwise, I think it's a mystery.
Yeah, I'd like to remind you of something on this point, is that it's known from data at Fermilab that the Cronin effect is different for particles of different species. Specifically, it's higher for protons. And you can understand this in a lowbrow way by just thinking that if you believe in an intrinsic KT, a multiple scattering, that effectively boosts the two-parton system before the vertex. So it acts like a transverse flow. It gives you a transverse velocity to the two-parton system. So if you just take the normal fragmentation functions but then boost them, you will get a rise in the proton over pion ratio from pure fragmentation without any multi-collisional flow process.
So you're saying we should measure it in P nucleus.
Right, this really points up the need for P nucleus to get the Cronin effect out by itself at this energy.
There's another question that may be not quite so practical, but at some point the predicted energy loss with PT goes down. So is there a PT beyond which you would not like to go?
Well, actually, I would like to go to high enough PT to see RAA come to 1, where we expect.
Whereabout do you think that would be?
Well,
maybe theorists should answer that.
I think the theorists should answer it, but I'm told somewhere between 10 and 15 GeV.
It's not so out of reach.
No, I think we can do it.
The point I want to make is the following. As Rolf and Xinyan explained us earlier in the afternoon, jets lose energy by induced radiation. And induced radiation is going to fragment into hadrons, so it's going to increase overall multiplicity. Now, if you believe that there is no shadowing, then already, without jet quenching, you are going to overpredict the observed multiplicity. So if you add jet quenching on top of this induced radiation, then I think the multiplicity which you are going to predict, you know, really has to be confronted with what you see experimentally. So I would avoid making conclusion at this point, but I would really say that it is important to cross-correlate what you observe in jet quenching with the total multiplicity, because this provides a very important constraint.
I mean, I guess I want to comment that something I've thought about, if the number of additional soft hadrons is large, then we already know that it's not consistent with the data. On the other hand, if the number of additional soft hadrons is a couple, then I think the way to really measure it is with the near angle correlations. And it's not easy, but that's the way to try to do it.
Barbara, you showed this one plot for the peripheral data set, and you meant this remark that it crosses one around 3 GeV, which you would expect from the Cronin effect at higher energies. Xinyang showed data from the Cronin effect at different energies. I think it was Fermilab in PA, and we always saw the crossing, I mean, RAA becoming one and crossing between 1 and 2 GeV.
I think it's more like 1.5, but let me check if I can find it.
And it seemed, I don't know, maybe Xinyang can correct me, but it looked on your plots, these four plots you had, as if the crossing at one was almost independent of the energy, or at least, you know, very close.
That's 4.5.
Well, that I think gets to what do you expect RAA should be, right? If you have what I would call a mess in the range between, I don't know, 2 and 3.5 GeV, where you have a mixture of soft stuff which, when you scale it with binary collisions, decreases RAA, and hard processes and multiple scattering / the Cronin effect, which increases it, I don't know how to make a quantitative prediction. And my point that I was wanting to make with the peripheral collisions is that we do actually get to an RAA around 1. So there we don't see the big suppression. Of course, if I take Brian's point that RAA should be larger than 1, perhaps we still see a suppression.
Could be 1.2.
Yes, I would like to actually comment on Beamer's question. And in fact, there is one additional effect that I didn't have time to discuss, is that when you calculate energy loss inside the medium, you have to consider additional effect like not only radiation but gluon absorption from the medium. And that absorption effect actually is very small when initial jet is very, energy is very large, but that absorption is significant, is very significant when the energy of the jet is about few times of the temperature. So in this case, that the energy loss, if you go to that small energy and then it will reach some kind of equilibration, there is really not much energy loss effect left over. So the energy loss essentially is only a phenomenon for high PT jet, and then the number of them in heavy ion interaction is quite small. Even if they produce extra particle, I don't think you can actually see that in heavy ion interactions. And on the initial condition problem, I think that the saturation or whatever the shielding effect are indeed initial state problem, which it should be different from the final state effect of the medium induced radiation. And I think to answer, even though you can you can set aside all the theoretic study in the past on the subject, but you can, what I will ask the experimentalists to do is to please do PA interaction in the next run. And of course, in the long run, the ultimate experiment is to photon tech jet. So there, you simply be free of initial condition problem, and the signature is really unique there.
We request the PA running as soon as possible, and we request the high luminosity so we can do the tag jets.
No, I think we know we have to go on. Let's thank the speaker.